All right. Welcome. So I've just got a couple of announcements to make. One is, I've heard some good things about your debates, and we look forward to good things on this Friday and the one following, or whenever they are. So make sure you throw yourselves into these debates. You will enjoy them much more when you do so, and the world will be then a happier place. I am sorry to say I will not be able to hold my informal office hour today at the Armadillo Grill. I have to fly the friendly skies for something else. Please make sure that when you are taking notes on your laptops in this class, that you use your laptops only to take notes. And I have noticed that some of you are strictly adhering to that policy and instead are using your iPhones. That is known as following the letter of the law rather than the spirit of the law. And as New Testament people, we believe in following the spirit of the law. We also believe a day of wrath is coming, so don't do that. Okay, it is my privilege to introduce our speaker for today. It's a special privilege since it is somebody other than me. Mr. Jason Staples, teaching assistant for this class, will be giving the lecture today on Pauline ethics. Jason came to UNC in 2007 after doing both a bachelor's degree and a master's degree at Florida State University, which did not get very far in the term. Jason is already an established teacher scholar. As a scholar, he has already published a number of articles, several encyclopedia entries, articles in religion, the journal Religion and Film, and an article in the leading journal, academic journal in the field of biblical studies, the Journal of Biblical Literature. In addition, he has been awarded as a teacher and has won the much coveted UNC University Tanner Teaching Award. Jason is now writing his dissertation in the Department of Religious Studies, a dissertation on the Apostle Paul, called Paul, the Gentiles, and the Restoration of Israel. And so, please join me in welcoming Jason Staples.
I should have done the Colbert run out with my arms out. All right, we better jump on this quick because I've got a lot to cover. There's a lot to cover if we're going to talk about Pauline ethics. So,
mic is off, isn't it?
Is it back on?
Yeah.
All right. And let me get my stuff up here. All right, you got me? All right. So, first thing we need to do if we're going to talk about Pauline ethics is we need to talk about what grace is. So, if we're going to talk about grace, which is a key term, as most of you probably already know, and you should know because you've already heard enough lectures and have read your assignments, I'm sure, about grace in Paul. We should have an idea of what grace is, but I'm not so sure that that we have, because Paul was not a 21st century capitalist. He was not a Western capitalist. And so for us to understand his terminology, we need to kind of get back into a different kind of world than what he's doing. So the first thing we need to do is talk about grace a little bit. Anybody here have any idea what grace might be if you're Paul? What does he mean when he uses this word? Anybody? Remember, I'm interactive, so I'll wait on you. You get a volunteer. Go. Okay, forgiveness. Any other options?
Giving you something good instead of punishment you deserve. So if you deserve something bad, instead of just giving you mercy, it's like reward.
Okay, so reward for bad stuff you did.
Or a gift.
Okay. A gift. Okay, good. Okay, undeserved favor, unmerited favor. That's probably the most common thing. One more.
Relief from my suffering.
Relief from suffering. Okay, so these are most common. Those are the most common modern explanations of what grace is. When you read the New Testament, and you're reading theologically, those are most commonly the things given. That's what I would expect. But for Paul's using a Greek word called the Greek word charis. And that word really means something more like, it has to do with relational currency. And he's coming out of a different kind of context than us. With us, when you go, we have an economy that's based on capitalism. So you go, you get a job, you work, you get paid, you sort of have a detachment between your pay and the relationships that you have friends that are detached from all sorts of different things. In the ancient world, they didn't have this kind of system. In the ancient world, they had a system that was more based on patrons and clients. So you'd have your wealthy landowners at the top, or your government figures. Oftentimes they were the same. You'd have your landowners at the top. You'd have a merchant class, yes, but then you'd have a lot of people that were dependent on this upper class, this wealthier class, to get work, to be able to farmland, whatever. You would receive these things from your tenant, and in exchange for this, you would give him allegiance, you would give him a proceeds of the crops, things like that. A good way to think about this is Caesar, for example. You give Caesar allegiance, Caesar provides protection. If you're a good enough friend of Caesar's, if you have enough allegiance with him and enough connections, he may put you in charge of Palestine like he did, or in charge of Judea like he did Pontius Pilate. And again, you are responsible to give things back. The thing that you exchange... So, if you're Pontius Pilate, the thing that you get from Caesar, if you get this particular prefecture or something like that, if you're put in charge, that thing that was given to you is called grace. And then what you owe back is grace in return. The word for thankfulness or thanks, you know, we give thanks. The word for that in the New Testament is the same word, is the same root word, and oftentimes the same word as the word grace. So grace is given by the superior party and also received back by the other party. So that's the other thing. Grace is always reciprocal. It is a reciprocal term. I'll never forget one of my early Greek professors in the classics department at Florida State. We were talking about something totally unrelated to the New Testament. Came across this word and he said, charis is always and everywhere a reciprocal term. So it expects a return. You don't give something without strings attached in this kind of world. So, if we're going to get a good example of this, we'll go to the world of favors in a great movie, The Godfather. Because, actually, this movie, yes, it is a 20th century movie, but the system of relationship that we see here goes all the way back to the ancient Mediterranean. So, take careful note here. What's happened is this guy's coming in, and he's asking... Don Corleone, the godfather, for a favor because his daughter has been beaten senseless by some people, and he went to the police, as you'll find out, and we'll pick up from there. So his daughter was beaten up and he wants justice.
I went to the police like a good American. Each divorce would go to trial. The judge sentenced them to 3 years in prison. You suspend the sentence. Suspend the sentence. They went free that very day. I stood in the court with me like a fool. And those two bastards, they smiled at me. Then I said to my wife, for justice, we must go to Don Corleone.
Why did you go to the police? Why didn't you come to me first?
What do you want from me? Tell me anything. What do I beg you to do?
What was that?
Attention to that part. Anything you ask.
We've known each other many years, but this is the first time you ever came to me in council. I can't remember the last time that invited me to your house for a cup of coffee. Even though my wife and godmother, your only child. But let's be frank, you never wanted my friendship.
King.
And you were afraid to be my dad.
I didn't want to get into trouble.
I understand. You found paradise in America. Had a good trade, made a good living, the police protected you, and there were courts of law. You didn't need a friend like that. But now you come to me and you say, Don Corleone, give me justice. So then that's my respect. You don't offer friendship. You don't even think to call me godfather. Instead of you coming to my house on the day my daughter's to be married, and you ask me for the murder money.
You ask me for justice.
That is not justice. Your daughter is going to die.
Maybe it's suffering. She suffers. How much shall I pay?
Notice that? So everybody catch that? This guy offers payment for a particular service. But Don Corleone is insulted and says he asked disrespectfully because he wanted to pay. He wanted to work for something that was going to be given for free so long as he had his allegiance. Right? So in this world, what really matters is this loyalty extended towards the Lord. The Godfather, in this case, faithfulness pledged towards him, and then he's going to take care of everything you need. This is the notion of grace that's in the New Testament. So if we understand that first and foremost, we can actually get to Paul's ethics. The next thing to understand, though, there's one other foundational element we really need to get to, and that is, remember, Paul is an apocalyptic thinker. He doesn't think like most people today. The thing that Paul is most concerned about is the judgment is coming. Judgment day is coming, and you better make sure you're on the right side because God's going to judge everybody. So how then can we assure that how can a person ensure that that person is going to be judged as righteous? That ends up becoming the question. Everything runs through that concern. And as it turns out, Paul tells us in several places, every place where he mentions judgment, and this may surprise some of you in here, every place where Paul mentions judgment, he says judgment is going to be by works. People are going to be judged by what they do. And the key to this, the prime premise that Paul's operating under, is God is just, which means people get what they deserve. Well, that's bad news for people who sinned, right? You'd think, and Paul elsewhere says, people have sinned. So we've got a problem. God is just. He's going to judge people as they deserve, and he's going to give people what they deserve on judgment day. Now we've got this problem of how can anybody be judged as righteous? And if God is just, by the way, and everybody's going to be judged by the same standard because God's just, then judgment is not guaranteed by things like having or knowing the law or the scripture. It's not by being ethnically Jewish. It's not by circumcision. Rather, in order to be judged as righteous, a person has to actually be righteous. Again, problem for those who are unrighteous. So then the operative question, and this is what most of Galatians and Romans deals with, is how can one then be justified? And you see this word happen, this word creeps up all the time in the letters of Paul as well. And this word, best taken most of the time, there are times where it means vindicated in judgment, but most of the time in his discussion, he's using the other side of the word, which means to be made righteous. This, by the way, is the same Greek word that's used for Joseph when he decides quietly to put Mary away because he's a just man. He's a righteous person. He does what would be the best possible thing in the situation is the idea. He does what's right. So how then can one become a person who's going to be judged this way? The next thing we've got to deal with, and again, this is all painting a picture of Paul's world so that we can actually get into a little bit of how he thinks. Hellenistic anthropology, in other words, how people in the Greco-Roman world thought about people and how Paul appears to think about people is also important. And this goes all the way back to Plato, and it's not just Plato, but it became pretty current in that time period. It was this idea of portraying the self, and this is, we say the soul, but it's really the self. The word for soul is self in this sense. Is as a tripartite thing, tripartite person. There are three parts to every person in this sense. The first is the intellect, the mind. And this is represented, as we would, by the head. It's the thing that can look up and contemplate the good. It's where the eyes light up the body. It's what allows you to learn, to know what is good. The next thing is the will, or the spirited part. And all this, by the way, you can get out of Plato's Republic. He talks about this a lot. And then there's tons of literature that develops on Plato up through the time of Paul and well after that. But the next part is the will, or the spirited part. And that's sort of depicted in here. It's in the sort of middle part of the body as the representative. And then you've got the appetitive part, or the part where you have your appetites, your drives. And that's the part that's represented by the belly or the genitals. Makes sense. And the issue is, why do people do what they do? Well, if you know what's right and your soul is in order, then your mind, knowing what's right, governs the rest of your body with the allegiance of the will, of the spirited part. So one way that an old professor of mine explained it is, if you think about it platonically, the will, that center part, that middle part of the soul, is sort of like an elevator. It can either go up and ally with the head, or it can go down and ally with the genitals or the belly. And the genitals or the belly, they don't have rationality. You desire sex without regard to whether or not the person is someone you should sleep with or not. You desire that sandwich or my burrito, regardless of whether or not that's your burrito or not. And without the mind to tell you that it's not right to take that, you would just take it and eat it if you're hungry, right? So the mind is what properly governs the body if the will is in right alignment. If it's not, though, if the will is not in right alignment, then we end up having a problem because the will allies with the appetitive part, and so you know what to do, and you still don't do it. Who here's had that experience before? You know the better thing to do, you know what you should do, and it really still isn't what you end up doing. And so here's the explanation that comes into out of the Hellenistic anthropology. Is there are a couple reasons that people do bad things. One is they may have false belief. In other words, their education in some way has been inferior or has led them to believe that certain things are good that aren't. So they do what they think is right, they do what they think is the good, but they're mistaken. The other thing is that, and this is what's really in view here, is a disorder in the soul where the will, the spirited part, that middle part, is defective. It's become weakened, and it's become an ally of the flesh, of the appetite part, and it sides against the mind. And then you're in trouble, because then you'll do things that you know not that you know you shouldn't do, but it doesn't matter. You're going to do them anyway. Your will has allied with the flesh. And this is all metaphorical, of course, but this is how they talked about it. Paul uses this same sort of dichotomy. In Romans 7, for example, some of you are familiar with this discussion of I do what I do not want to do, but that which I want to do, I do not do, and you know, there's all this do and do not do stuff. But basically this idea that he steps into the character of someone who has a disordered soul, who's disordered in their ethical function, and says, listen, with my mind, I know what is right and good, and I agree with the law that it is good, but in my body, I'm a slave to the law of sin and death. Right? His appetitive parts, his drives, have overpowered his mind. So what then is the solution for Paul? The solution, is he explains in Romans 8, which, by the way, Romans 8 undoes in a very orderly fashion all the statements that he makes in that section of Romans 7. God provides a new spirit, a new part in the middle for people that's actually God's spirit. It's the spirit of Christ that comes in and now actually not only will provide the will to do what's right and side with the mind, but also train the mind. So the person gets into right order and does what's right. Right? Everybody following? Is everybody following?
Yes.
Okay, good. So the issue here is how God, according to Paul, provides his spirit to actually make a previously unrighteous, disordered person into a righteous person. That's the issue. And he does this in order that, and so this, by the way, provides a way that God can then judge people as righteous. Righteous people, these people have been made righteous by the Spirit. Righteous people do righteous things. So when it comes to judgment, how will you be judged if you do righteous things? Be judged as righteous, right? You were previously unrighteous, you would be judged as unrighteous. God has provided a spirit. He makes you into a righteous person who does righteous things by participation in the spirit, joining to the body of Christ. Now you can be righteous, and God will justly judge that person as righteous, Paul says. But this gets to another core issue. If this is the case, if this is how God deals with the problem of unrighteousness, what about the law? That brings up a major problem, because before, in Judaism, the means of God's grace, and we talked briefly, or at least your readings have had a little bit about covenantal gnomism, right? This idea that God made a covenant with his people and provided a guide for how they were to live in response to that covenant, right? We talked about this? Do we remember that? Vaguely, early in the semester? The issue here, though, is, and by the way, that starts to look a lot like the Godfather thing again, right? God graciously chooses them to be in relationship. They come to him. He gives them guidelines. They follow. But now we've got the Spirit that comes in and seems to be sitting in the place of the law. The law previously was what gave you the instruction. Now we've got the Spirit. What do we do with the law? Now we've got a problem, right? We've got two things that are supposed to be doing the same function. Paul's answer to this is that those who have the Spirit will naturally fulfill the law, the things that the law really requires, and he makes a big fuss about this, what he calls the righteous requirements of the law. And he says that those who have the Spirit will naturally fulfill these things and will be judged righteous. Okay? Are you following up so far? So he finds a way to, in that case, to kind of hedge his bets a little bit. The next argument he makes, and here he's got several arguments to try to defend his case here. The next argument that he makes is, who actually needs law anyway? So let me ask you a question. If everybody drove the speed limit, If everybody just drove the speed limit, would we need speed limits? Would we need posted signs? If everybody just naturally drove a safe speed, would we need speed signs? No. That's effectively Paul's argument in this case. Who needs the law? Well, we need the law because we've got lawbreakers. So he actually presumes that lawbreaking comes before the law. You only make a law because people are already doing the thing you're prohibiting. So Paul and his opponents agree that following the flesh leads to wickedness. But his opponents argue that the law is needed to restrain the flesh. God gave the law so that we could restrain the flesh. And by the way, circumcision, as we'll talk about, is actually a representative example of just that. So for Paul's opponents, the law is needed to restrain the flesh. But with Paul, what he argues is that only a person who's disordered and unrighteous needs this restraint. If you already have the Spirit, and the Spirit's directing you to do the right things, and motivates you to do the right things, and already is fulfilling the right things in you by nature, what need is there to have an external law to follow? Because the law is only really there to restrain people from doing the things that they've...
I just lost my
mic, didn't I? There we go. To keep people from doing the things that, according to the Spirit, they wouldn't be doing anyway. So people who have the Spirit don't need the law. That's his argument.
Again, speed limits example.
Paul's own example about this, what he actually addresses, is he talks about the law and its function as what he calls a paedagogos. This is a Greek word referring to a sort of a household tutor that wealthier families would have to sort of raise and discipline children. You think about like a governess, something like that, where it's a person in charge of education, of the education of the children, moral training of the children. And this person in Greek literature was often sort of caricatured as sort of a harsh, gruff taskmaster, kind of a crotchety old you know, guy with a stick who gives you a whooping if you're bad. And so
basically this person, this paedagogos, was in charge of the young child,
and up through pretty late in life, up until the person was of age and was essentially qualified to live on his own, and then, you know, that would be dispensed with. There'd be no need for the paedagogos anymore.
No need for this tutor. So what Paul says is that the law itself is really a paedagogos, is really this character.
That until you actually are mature enough to do what's right by nature, well, yeah, you need something out external to tell you what to do. But once you learn that you don't drive over a certain speed because it'll kill you, once you learn that, you really don't even need to pay attention to the speed signs because you'll drive the natural speed. What's really necessary is that we understand it as instruction and we get to the point of it. What is it really telling us to do? How are we really supposed to live? But once we get to maturity, we don't need all the little things here that you know, the law's got this spanking in place for us if we don't do it this way. Well, now that we're actually of age, now that we're heirs, as he says to the Galatians, now that we're truly filled with the Spirit and we already have the motivation to do what's right and we know what to do, then there's no need for the law. So the law is for the unrighteous. In so doing, he argues that doing certain works of the law, like circumcision, which remember, circumcision is just basically snipping off of that little flesh at the end of the penis, of the foreskin, it's a good lecture anytime you can get both the Godfather and the word penis into the lecture. So basically what he does is he argues that things like circumcision, see, circumcision was looked at as something that would help restrain the flesh. Because what is representative of the appetitive part of the person? The belly or the genitals. And if you cut off the extra piece of flesh at the end, it's a reminder that you only use that certain ways. It's actually one of the reasons that circumcision began to be more widely practiced in the United States again, a little over 100 years ago, because they thought it would keep little boys from masturbating so much. So the idea is that, you know, it's a restraining impact on the flesh. And that's only one of the reasons that circumcision was pushed. There are all sorts of others in Paul's case that he's arguing against. But he basically says, listen, if you've got the Spirit, you already have a spiritual circumcision. You don't need something else to restrain the flesh. And for Paul, a person who's baptized into Christ, their flesh is already effectively dead. Christ already died. And if you've become a part of Christ by participating in His Spirit, then your flesh has no power either, because it's just like Christ's flesh. It's dead. So this is the argument that he makes. So for him, righteousness only comes through grace, which for him is the gift of the Spirit. See, God as the Godfather works really well, doesn't it? God as the Godfather dispenses the Spirit to people as the means of grace. Those who come to God and pledge their allegiance to Christ and to God receive the grace of His Spirit, which gives them guidance to do what is right. And then all that's necessary is faithfulness. Well, you see this word faith all the time in the New Testament. Most of the time, when it's used as a noun in the Greek world, most of the time, that word means faithfulness or loyalty. Oftentimes in the context of like a treaty or, some pledge of this to a higher entity, something like that. Or what we would consider like between a husband and a wife. How do we know that they're faithful to one another? Well, they have this agreement and that they maintain. They're faithful. That's what that word often means. For Paul, it means that quite a bit. Other times it does mean belief, but he's got, it means much more than belief. And Bart already addressed that in his in some of his lecture earlier this semester. But anyhow, for him, righteousness, true righteousness, only comes through the grace of God, through by participation in the Spirit and subsequent faithfulness. By the way, a lot of you have heard this, if you confess with your mouth, believe in your heart. Anybody know that verse? Right? Another way to translate that is if you pledge allegiance with your mouth. Homologeo is often used in the context of pledging allegiance to a leader or to a person. So again, it's falling within this context, this socio-historical context it's not feudalism, but this socio-historical context of client and patron. God is patron and us as the client. So for Paul, here's another way of boiling that argument down. And this is how he goes in Galatians 6, Galatians 5 and 6. He says, following the flesh leads to wickedness, no question. And so you need the law to restrain your unrighteousness. So a wicked person who has a disordered soul and all these other things, yeah, they need extra restraint, they need extra training, they need all this stuff. But the righteous person who follows the Spirit, that leads to faithfulness. And if you've got faithfulness, then the law is unnecessary. You already have the righteousness you need. And that's produced, again, by participation in the Spirit. So this is bottom line for Paul. So once we're here, we end up having effectively a foundation for Pauline ethics. Once we're there, we have a foundation that we can actually now get to talking about how then should people live. Because you run into a problem, right? I mean, this is where Paul runs into some problems of consistency, right? So you mean to tell me that if I receive the Spirit, then I don't need to listen to what anybody else says because I'm already going to have the motivation to do what's right. So I don't need the law. I don't need external instruction. I'm just going to do what's right. So why should I listen to you, Paul? Right? It's kind of can run into some potential logical issues here. And this is where his whole notion of moving into maturity that he has elsewhere kind of comes in. But we do run into this problem. So what we do have is he does, interestingly, operate from the assumption most of the time that you know what's right by the law. And this is one of the more interesting aspects of Paul. Is on the one hand, he's busy telling everybody, listen, when you have the Spirit, You don't need to follow the little things of the law because it's just a paedagogos, and it's not, you know, doing these works of the law is not what makes a person righteous. Righteous people do righteous things. So doing a particular work of the law isn't going to make you righteous. It only testifies to it, if anything. But he still runs into this issue of the law is actually the source of where he gets most of his ethical and moral instruction. So Paul's view of sexuality, for example, he says essentially the same stuff that the Torah does. He doesn't change any of that, which is interesting. And then he tells people, you're going to be judged according to whether or not you do these things. So he has it both ways a little bit. The righteous people don't need the law, but if you're unrighteous, you'll be judged by the law. And how do you know what's right and wrong for sure? Well, it's in the law. But if you're really righteous, you don't need the law to tell you that. So it's a little bit of an issue there. The next foundation, the next criterion that he has for how to determine whether or not you should do something, how should you actually live in terms of ethics, is the teachings of Jesus. But interestingly, he doesn't really deal with this very much. As Bart mentioned earlier in the semester, there's very, very little that Paul actually says about what Jesus said. You get a little bit in 1 Corinthians where he talks about Jesus' teaching on divorce. There's a mention of Jesus' teaching on whether preachers should get paid. But there's not much else. So, doesn't seem to be as big of an emphasis for how Paul is constructing the way that people should go about living as you might expect. On the other hand, the example of Christ, especially the example of Christ in his death, in his going to the cross, is seen as a major foundation for ethics. So on the one hand, you know you're disobedient because you're breaking certain things in the law, and Paul's pretty selective about what those things are. On the one hand, you know you're disobedient if you do those things, but you know that you're obedient if you're following the example of Christ, which is that you are giving yourself, that you're considering yourself less than the person who is across from you, that you are loving your neighbor as yourself, which comes to the love command, that you are exhibiting sacrificial love, if you will, that you lower yourself, you live by humility. And this is the Philippians 2 thing, that let this mind be in you, which is also in Christ, who, being in the form of God, did not think equality with God something to be grasped, but instead he humbled himself. He says, this is how you should be. But the real issue, the real place that he spends a lot of time is, and again, Paul does believe, he does, well, at least let's say this, he does say, whether he believes it or not is something else, but he does say, and I think we at least can assume that he believes it, he does say that he thinks that his gospel ultimately fulfills the law, that people who follow his gospel fulfill the law. Even though they're not doing things like circumcision, they're fulfilling what the law really requires. That's what he argues. And how does he argue that? He says, well, actually, love is what fulfills the law. If you love your neighbor as yourself, if you love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, then you actually fulfill the law. So, and we see this, by the way, those are the references where the love command comes in the Hebrew Bible. The first one is to love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, and mind. And then the two passages of Leviticus address loving your neighbor as yourself. And for Paul, these things, and actually we see in the Synoptic Gospels at least, we see this discussed as well of what actually are the what are the prime commands of the law? What are the things that the law is built on? And it's this principle of the love command. But again, we're 21st century people. We have a hard time understanding what love means in the context of the Hebrew Bible and in the New Testament. So we need to get to the meaning of the term. Yes?
Is it possible that the Synoptic Gospels got the idea of love for from Paul?
Anything's possible in that front. I mean, Paul is influential, but I don't think it's likely that the Synoptics got it from Paul. And the main reason it's pretty unlikely is that Paul is certainly not the first person to have said this either. We see this in a Jewish rabbinic tradition that comes out as well that predates both Jesus and Paul. So they're not saying something new here. And actually, the Synoptic Gospels imply that when Jesus gives this answer, he's giving the answer that the Pharisees would give the thumbs up to. In fact, in at least one passage, he has the teacher of the law that Jesus asks give that answer. It's the right answer. So it's unlikely that they're getting it from Paul, but Paul's probably taking this actually from pre-Christian Jewish tradition, that the law fulfills the law. There's actually a rabbinic story, a really fun rabbinic story, where two different rabbis, Hillel and Shammai, and Shammai was known as sort of he's a hard guy, you know, kind of guy who was kind of rude. And a Gentile walked up to Shammai and asked him, Can you explain the whole law to me while standing on one foot? Implying, you better do it short. You know, make it short, because you're not going to be able to stand on one foot very long. It says, Shammai chased him away with a trowel. Right? And then the rest of the story is that this same guy went and posed the same question to Hillel. And Hillel, by the way, is before Jesus' ministry. He's in the like teens of the first century. And Hillel says, yeah, sure, that which is hateful, do not do that which is hateful to your neighbor. That's the whole law. So this is a tradition that most likely predates both Jesus and Paul, and that they're both pulling from. So odds are that both historical figures, given their context, would probably say this. At any rate, the meaning of the term is really important. What does it mean to love your neighbor? Because it does, I mean, clearly, if we all loved one another, like, you know, in certain ways, that would be a very odd world if we had to love all of our neighbors. I'm thinking of, wow, this would be a really, 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 this would be a movie that even Hollywood couldn't do. But what we do have, the notion of love that Paul really highlights, goes back to this example of Jesus and the cross, where he basically says it's this idea of valuing others on par, and actually Paul really points to above yourself, consider others before yourself, and make a full commitment to whatever is best for the other person. That's effectively the idea that Paul's getting after. So do the thing that is best for the other person in a relationship. And if you do that, Paul says, then you fulfill the law. So there's the one ethical guide that Paul really hangs his hat on, is love your neighbor. And if you do this, you fulfill the law. And if you fulfill the law, then you'll be judged as righteous. Now, how do you do this? How do you know what's loving? Well, you've got the Spirit. You've got Scripture as a pedagogos. If, you know, in some way you don't know what's right, but ultimately, love fulfills the law, is the idea. And so, for Paul, he then applies this in some very interesting ways. And he has to apply it this way, in part because he doesn't want to just point back to the law and say, well, the law says this, therefore. What he wants to do is he wants to show that this one thing, this love command that encapsulates the whole law, can actually apply to anything. So should I eat meat sacrifice? First thing on the list, spiritual gifts. How should I handle spiritual gifts? We've got the love chapter, as Bart pointed out on Monday. The love chapter is sandwiched right between chapter 12 and chapter 14 of 1 Corinthians, which both deal with spiritual gifts, because the church is a mess. They basically have a bunch of people babbling on in other tongues and handling snakes, while other people are really not sure whether they should be there or not. And Paul says, listen, the loving thing is for you not to get all wild about this and speak in tongues and go nuts. If you want to do that on your own time. But when you're together as a group, think about other people in front of yourself and have some order. Have some decorum. Why? Because this is the loving thing to do. This is what's right. So he applies it in that case. Which, by the way, Bart, not every wedding had that applied. That I at my wedding, I made sure that that was forbidden. That was strictly verboten from the clergy that married me and my wife. I was like, you can pick a lot of passages, but that one's not going to be in my wedding. So not every wedding. The next example that Paul uses is meat sacrificed to idols. The next issue that we can talk about. He talks about meat sacrificed to idols, and Bart talked about this at length on Monday, so we won't spend too much time with it. But again, his reasoning, the way that you come about how you should live, the ethics, the ethical foundation is not to point back to the law and say, you shouldn't do it, which would have been a lot easier for Paul. But again, his whole case is only the unrighteous need the law. If we have the Spirit and we operate by the love command, then we'll fulfill the law anyway, so that's what we should do. So he's trying to be consistent here by applying this to meat sacrifice to idols. And it ends up in a pretty tortured argument. As a lot of interpreters have found when they try to go there, it doesn't all seem to stick together. But his basic thing, at least in one passage, is, listen, if you're going in and you're eating meat that sacrifice to idols, and you knowingly do this, and you do this in front of somebody who has a conscience, whose conscience says it wouldn't be that they shouldn't eat meat sacrificed to idols because that's participating in idolatry, then you've caused your neighbor, your brother or sister, to sin. Well, is that the loving thing to do? Of course not. So, should you eat meat sacrificed to idols? No, you should not eat meat sacrificed to idols. It does leave a loophole. Unless, of course, you don't know whether it was sacrificed to idols, don't ask, don't tell. First example of that policy that I know of in history is actually Paul's use of don't ask, don't tell on meat sacrificed to idols. Somebody gives you meat, don't ask where they got it from. Then you can eat it with a free conscience, and then you can eat it without having to worry about this whole question of whether you're making somebody stumble. But if you know that it was sacrificed to an idol, then the loving thing is not to eat it. Why? Because you could cause someone else to stumble. You could cause them to think that Christ is united to idols. And then that would be a problem. See how that works? So this effectively is how Paul gets around constantly applying the law, even though ultimately he is applying the law. He's having his cake and eating it too. So in summary, the way that Paul actually deals with his ethics, Paul's ethical stricture is that we, let's go back to the beginning. Everything goes back to the judgment. How are we going to be judged? We're going to be judged based on whether we're righteous or not. How are we righteous? Well, you've got to fulfill the law. How do you fulfill the law? Well, the law is actually fulfilled by grace, by having received the Spirit, which fulfills the law without needing the law. And then the love command actually is how you go about that with the Spirit. So ultimately, the summary of all this for Paul is have the Spirit and follow the Spirit. And if you do that, then you'll basically do everything right. Your ethical basis, your moral basis are covered. You're going to do things right because the Spirit will have made you a righteous person. And a righteous person is someone who loves other people and who loves God, and therefore does what God asks and what is best for other people. So for Paul, if you want to be righteous, if you want to have good ethics, then it's very clear. You just follow the Spirit. So, any questions before we go? We are pretty close out of time. Any questions? All righty, that's it. Thanks, everybody.